May it please the court?
Miss Hennick.
Yes.
I know these people seated beside me. And you know the
May it please the court, my name is Ellen Hennick, and I represent the petitioner Anthony D.B. The issue that we're here to decide today is whether you can forcibly medicate someone under Chapter 980. Now, Chapter 980 is silent, has absolutely nothing in it concerning forcible medication. The question therefore becomes whether the provisions of 51.61, subsection 1, subsection G, apply in 980 cases in their entirety with all of their protections. The issue is not whether it applies in pieces as the state would have it. If it applies, it applies all the way across the board, including review after a year. The issue is also not whether the legislature could authorize forcible medication. It's very clear that they could. The question here is, did they? Now, 5161 subsection 1 in general is a right-granting statute which has a bunch of enumerated rights, listed 23 of them, that apply to patients. Now, patients, as it's defined, does include people under 980. The interesting thing, though, is the patient also includes people under 971, committed under 971. It also includes people committed under 975. But not all of those 23 listed rights apply to all of those people. So the fact that patient includes the people under Chapter 980 does not automatically mean that 5161.1G, which deals with medication, applies. For example, 5161 subsection D, which includes a right to petition for review or withdrawal or release, clearly does not apply in Chapter 980, does not apply in Chapter 971. Similarly, it's very clear that in 971, 975, subsection E doesn't apply, which involves least restrictive conditions, and that's by its own terms. Subsection I doesn't apply, which involves freedom from restraint and isolation. Interestingly enough, 5161.1G also does not apply in 971 cases or 975 cases. And our argument is that it doesn't apply in 980 cases either. That provision was intended to grant a limited right to refuse medication. But you only have a right to refuse medication if there's any possibility that you can be forcibly medicated in the first place. So what's missing is the legislature granting the power to forcibly medicate. And without that power, there's no need for a right to refuse it under certain circumstances.
Counsel, could you explain what you just said? That 971 does not apply under 5161.1G?
Right. If you medicate someone who is committed under Chapter 971, the provision that applies is 971.17.3, subsections B and C. It's very clear that 5161.1G does not apply. There was a time when it did, when this court expanded the right to refuse medication to people who were involuntary. Well, let me go back a step. Originally, the right to refuse medication only applied to people who were who voluntarily committed themselves. In a case called State X. Rel. Jones versus Gerhardstein, this court expanded that right to people who were involuntarily committed. At that point, 5161.1G presumably applied not only to people under 51, it applied to people committed under 971, and it applied to people committed under 975. Apparently, the legislature did not think that that was the appropriate way to handle this, because what happens immediately after that is they take the people in 971 out of 5161.1G, and they do that by enacting 971.17. And they take the people committed under 975 out of it, and they do that by enacting 975.06, subsection 7. So it is clear that when this court said in State X. Rel. Jones versus Gerhardstein, hey, this is a right to refuse medication and it applies to everyone committed, that that was not what the legislature had in mind. Now, if you look closely at 5161.1g, and you try and apply it in 980, you begin to have a few problems. First of all, it's not clear whether a person would need to meet the criteria for dangerousness that normally someone under Chapter 51 would have already met before you ever get to the forcible medication.
Why is that?
Well, in 51, if you look at the criteria for committing under 51, there is a recent dangerousness requirement. If you look at Chapter 980, and you look at the grounds for committing on the sexually violent persons, there is no time limitation to that. So theoretically, the dangerousness would be only sexual, which doesn't necessarily relate to what's actually going on with forcible medication. We're not talking about forcibly medicating Anthony D.B. because he is sexually violent. We're talking about whether we need to forcibly medicate him because he's a schizophrenic.
And your argument then is in Chapter 51 you need, as one of the elements, a finding of recent conduct which results in dangerousness, and that is nowhere to be found in 980. Is that what you're suggesting?
It certainly isn't found in the same way in 980. When you look at this case, the predicate offense for the commitment of Anthony D.B. is quite a few years before you get to the forcible medication order. And that could be true. You can't get that when you get to Chapter 51. You're going to have to talk about what's happened recently. Now, the
Ms. Hennick, let me interrupt for a minute and ask you how this all ties into your client. As I understand, the Court of Appeals affirmed the action taken by the trial court. Mm-hmm. Two of the judges on the Court of Appeals put significance on the fact that 51.61 paren 1 includes within the definition of patient Chapter 980 committees. But Judge Shudson, in his concurrence, said, you know, this is a lot of, and I'm paraphrasing now, this is a lot of to-do about nothing, because all of the rights that your client would have had under 51 were adhered to. He was given every right. The hearing that was conducted was an appropriate hearing and met the criteria for 51, so there's no harm whether or not 51 covers. What's your answer to that?
My answer to that is, if the legislature has not granted a right to forcibly medicate, you can give rights as to how you do it till the cows come home. There's still no power in the courts to do it, and there's
no power
in the state to do it.
Don't you find it significant that the definition of patient in Chapter 51 includes people who are committed under 980? Doesn't that link seem to be a significant one? The majority of the Court of Appeals certainly thought it was. Why is it not?
If that's true, then 5161D, which gives a right to petition for review or withdrawal or release, also applies. If this court's prepared to do that...
Is that the issue before us?
Well, if you're saying that, not directly, but if you're saying that the statement that Section 1 says 980 is a patient, and that's all it takes to apply all of the rights listed, then all of the rights listed apply, unless they say otherwise. And certainly 5161D, which is a right to petition for review under Chapter 51, would apply. Several others, like subsection I that I mentioned before, the freedom from physical restraint, would clearly apply. You can't say it applies because patient is up in the definition, but we only have to give some of them. I don't think there's any basis on which you can do that.
Well, let's try it another way. Is it your position that unless there's a statute that says that a 980, I'll use the word prisoner for the moment, That someone who is kept patient, I'm sorry, a 980 patient, that the your position is that the state cannot medicate them unless they agree, unless there's a statute authorizing it?
They can't under statute, under 980. They could, and I think in this case there was an argument that, they could. He would meet the 51 criteria. You can do it under Chapter 51. It's not incompatible. You can detain him in the same place, 51.20. Same disposition is theoretically possible under that same statute. What you get, the additional thing that you get, is you get somebody checking in that the medication, not just when you first medicate him, but down the road. And one of the things about true mental illness is it changes.
Then are you saying that you have to have him involuntarily committed for treatment under 5120?
Unless he's agreeing to take his medication,
okay.
Which
he's
is a separate
agreeing.
Issue.
He's not agreeing. He's a 980 patient. Can the state give him medication without anything more?
Not unless they commit him under 51.
That's
what
my
I'm
question.
Saying.
So okay. your position here is, if you want to medicate him, mm-hmm. you go under all of 51.
You commit him under 51, and you can commit him under both statutes.
Which is both, 980 and 5120.
Right. Right.
And then unless you get him committed under 5120, you can't go to 61.1G.
That's exactly what the argument is, yes.
And your argument is that although he's a patient under 51.61 for purposes of definition, all of these principles don't apply because just looking at them, you know they don't apply. Well, how do you pick out the ones that don't apply and how do you pick out the ones that do apply?
Well, that in and of itself is an interesting question. Now, I think the state would not disagree that 5161D, if it applies, somewhat conflicts with some of the provisions in 980. So
right.
That one obviously can't apply for that reason.
Right.
Now,
what about the right to send sealed mail and receive sealed mail to and from a legal counsel? Let's see.
Well, I would think that it would apply unless there's some reason to think that it doesn't. And the argument here is there is reason to think that 5161 1G, based on its history, does not.
Okay, tell us about that.
All right. The history of it is that initially it provided that people who were voluntarily medicated could refuse medication. There was no provision for anyone involuntarily committed to ever refuse medication.
Then you got the Gerhardsen case.
Then you get Gerhardsen. And the court says, got to apply to everybody across the board. The next thing that happens within 2 years after that decision, now remember there's no 980 around at that
right.
point. The only other two groups to which it can apply are those under 971 and those under 975, which for the most part no longer exists. Those two groups, the legislature immediately takes out of 5161 1G. That's a suggestion that the legislature was saying, no, this particular right is tied to Chapter 51, and that's what we intended it to be. And when you look at it, and you start looking down 5161 1G, there are some glitches in trying to directly apply it. For example, if you look at the provision, who are you supposed to notify?
What subsection?
5161 1G. If you look, who do you notify for doing one of these hearings? It's the Corporation Council. Well, the Corporation Council has nothing to do with 980s. There are a few other people listed in here, but those few other people, if you track it down, are people who act as Corporation Council. If you follow the numbers through, you'll see some other numbers there.
How is it taken out of 5161 1G? Or 971. How was it taken out of that?
Is your question how did 971 become have a separate medication and not be under that?
Yeah.
Okay. It's taken out by the legislature amending 971 to include a much more specific 971-geared right to refuse medication. And that's currently found at 971.17.3.
Okay. Now, how are they different?
Off the top of my head, just a second. I don't remember what all of the differences were. I didn't sit down and contrast them. I'm sorry, I really can't answer that question.
You assume that they're geared to that kind of person.
It's small procedural differences in terms of who you notify and when your hearing is. It's that sort of thing.
Well, I thought you said that the legislature was certainly empowered to put something in Chapter 9A that specifically authorized involuntary medication.
Yes.
All right. And I suspect the legislature was specifically authorized to put something in 971. That authorized involuntary medication.
Yes.
The fact that they put it in 971 doesn't necessarily wipe out what the language is in 5161.1G, does it?
Well, it does to the extent that if you look up in 5161.1, they didn't do it by taking the word, by taking 971 out of patient. 971 people are still patients under 5161. There is nothing in 5161.1G itself that says, hey, this doesn't apply in 971. So they could have done it either way, I think. The fact that they chose to do it one way or another doesn't say anything about how they could do it here. It just says that their intent was it didn't apply beyond 51.
I think your argument would be much more compelling if you could point to something in Chapter 971 that was completely inconsistent with the provisions in 5161, and so that you'd say, look, the legislature was repudiating 5161.1G.
I don't think it was repudiating it in total. There are some small differences, and as I said, unfortunately, I don't have the statute in front of me, and I wish I did. There's some small procedural differences. And one of the ways that you see that that was in fact necessary is if you look at 5161.1G now. I cannot imagine that the legislature would intend that in a 980 case where the Corporation Council has not been involved at all in any way, that the person you would notify in order to enter a medication order would suddenly be the Corporation Council, for example. So there are some pieces that don't work anyway.
Well, 971.17.3, which 3B says, if the state proves by clear and convincing evidence the person is not competent to refuse medication or treatment for the person's mental condition under the standards specified in 971.16.3, the court shall issue as part of the commitment order an order that the person is not competent to refuse treatment, and that whoever administers the medication or treatment to the person shall observe appropriate medical standards.
Yes, the two provisions are slightly different.
Doesn't seem to be much of a procedure here. For a notification.
Well, the timing is a little bit different if you look at them.
Not less than 10 days before trial or any other time that the court directs, the physician appointed under 2 shall file a report. Contents of the report shall be confidential and ability to understand. That's the standard here. The defendant is not competent to refuse medication if, because of mental illness, etc., if one of the following is true, incapable of expressing an understanding, otherwise it is.
But one of the differences here, and it's really key, is that in order to get to a medication order under 971, you have certain findings, and you're going to have found that the person has a traditional mental illness, what we traditionally think schizophrenia, what used to be called manic depression, I think it's now called bipolar. If you look at 975 in the old statute, it used to get to the same place. 51, that's clearly going to be true. The big problem that here is that in order to get a commitment under 980, you don't have to be mentally ill in the way that we've traditionally understood it. And this court said that themselves under Adams. You can have a personality disorder. And normally, a personality disorder would not be something you would want treated with psychotropic drugs. But we don't know that that won't be true up the road, because as you start looking at what's happened with drugs, things have changed. But you're not having the same kind of finding here to start you on. And I think that that's a problem.
But there, Judge Dugan held a hearing, and he made the very, and there was testimony, and there was procedure. And how were the findings any different from what the findings would have been under Chapter 5161?
What he did was he said, let's assume Chapter 5161. Now, I would ask at a minimum, if this court rejects my argument, that you require that it be followed all the way along. My biggest concern here is that we could say, okay, 980, you can forcibly medicate, you can use 5161, but not apply all of the protections, because some of those protections are not specifically within 5161-1G. What has not been covered here, and the procedure that was not followed here, was if you do Chapter 51, that order, because the 51 order expires in a year, the medication order also expires in a year, and it gets a judicial review. That's what's not happening here. So when you say all of the procedures are followed, there has been no such review.
Counsel, I expected you to answer earlier on when Justice Crooks asked a question. I expected you to respond with the Roberta S. case, and you didn't. The question, and I hope I have this right, but in large part it was, look at 5161, 980 is listed there, and it must mean what it says, that in other words, 980
right.
is a patient there under 51. Why didn't you respond with the Roberta S. case? There must be a reason.
The only reason that I didn't, I think that the Court of Appeals was exactly right in that case. The only reason I didn't was because it was the Court of Appeals and not this court.
Well, let's...
And perhaps it shouldn't have been.
Yeah, I mean, the Court of Appeals law is law of this
right.
state. And Roberta S. says... Roberta S. says that under 55 and 80,
right.
and you look at 5161 in Chapter 55... people are patients under 5161.
Right.
And Roberta S. says that the court had no authority in a Chapter 55 proceeding. It's tantamount to not having competency, as I, you know, I'm using that
exactly.
term a bit loosely. There is no authority for a court in a Chapter 55 proceeding to involuntarily require forced medication. You gotta go under and initiate a 51 proceeding. That's exactly, I mean, that's my understanding.
That's
of
exactly
what
they were
saying. And so even though 55 is mentioned as a 5161 patient, Roberta S. says that's not good enough. In fact, it says that the court exceeded its statutory authority and offended due process, and a separate petition under 51 is necessary.
And I think that
I think that's what
it is. That's, that's exactly what Roberta S. says. The other piece of it is that it says when you take something that's supposed to provide protections, which you cannot do, and 5161 is sometimes referred to as the Patient Bill of Rights, it clearly was intended to extend protection. What it says is that you can't turn that around and suddenly make it the tool to take away rights. Which, if you're talking forcible medication, to say you have a right not to be forcibly medicated doesn't mean I'm necessarily granting you the power to do it. And that would be the way that this court would be using it, because there's nothing in 980, just like there was nothing in 55, that says you may forcibly medicate.
Could I ask this? People who are committed under Chapter 980, how long are they committed?
Basically until they're released. It's an indefinite commitment.
They can get a review
if they request it for the review would be, there is a paper review, it's not a court review. They can also get a review for supervised release, if they want to go under supervised release. What's not clear is whether as part of that review you also get a review of the medication, even if you're getting a review of whether you ought to be committed. That's clear. That's not clear.
I guess what I'm getting at is this. If the people supervising those who have been committed under Chapter 980 knew that psychotropic medication would be helpful and might lead to increased chances of release and didn't give the patient those drugs, I think you'd be in here and saying you're trying to keep this person confined. Wouldn't you make that argument?
Actually, I wouldn't. And the reason that I wouldn't is because I'm very well aware of the problems of forcible medication. It is not an across-the-board, oh, this is wonderful. There are some real terrible side effects to some of these drugs, and there are some real close questions at times about whether you give them. There can be heart problems, and if you want a really good listing of them, you can look in Jones. And there is a history both in this country, if you look, and you can find cases on this. There is a history. It is all too easy to look at somebody and say, and I think we see this in classrooms with things like Ritalin, it's all too easy to say that what appears to be in my interest is also in the patient's interest. And that's why I would be very careful about making that argument. Because it's easy to say, if this kid would just stop wiggling, boy, I could teach him a whole lot better. Well, it may be true, but if there's some very bad side effects to that, you may have to put up with some wiggling. The same thing happens with psychotropic drugs. If you've got a client whose hallucinations may be less, as for example Anthony's may be, but in exchange for that, you've got a very real large risk that this is going to cause a major heart attack, I think that that question becomes a very hard question, and I don't think you can look at it in one piece without the other. And I'm afraid that the tendency, and I think the history would suggest, the tendency would be, well, since he's easier to manage, it's easy, not intentionally, but it's easy for me to think that what's best for me is what's best for him. And that's why I personally, at least, would not make that argument.
Thank you, Ms. Hennig.
Thank you.
You have several minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Karen Timberlake arguing for the state. Ms. Timberlake.
May it please the court. I am Assistant Attorney General Karen Timberlake, and I represent the state in this appeal. The legislature enacted Chapter 980 with two goals in mind. First was the goal of protecting the public from sexually violent persons, and second, the legislature also intended to provide treatment to those persons. When the legislature created Chapter 980, as the court has been discussing already this afternoon, it included individuals committed under Chapter 980 in the definition of patients entitled to rights under 5161 sub 1. This court has previously held in the State versus Post case that the patient's rights provided in 5161 apply to individuals committed under Chapter 980. So there really should be no further debate here this afternoon about whether those rights apply. Accordingly, individuals committed under Chapter 980 have the right to refuse medication and treatment unless they are ordered by a court to take that medication and treatment consistent with the procedures spelled out in 5161.1g. If I could commend one principle of statutory interpretation to the court's attention this afternoon, it would be the principle that the specific statute controls over the general. I think that that principle answers a number of the questions that the court had for Ms. Hennig earlier. It is certainly the case that there are more specific provisions in Chapter 980, for example, on the issue of petitioning for supervised release, that would control rather than the supervised release provision in 5161. The legislature has created an entire commitment scheme and enforcement scheme under Chapter 980, and that scheme should be followed where it applies.
In 980 commitment, what do you do with the need for recency as an element that normally exists in 51?
This court has held previously that the differences in the commitment standards between Chapter 51 and Chapter 980 are not constitutionally significant, except for the original lack in Chapter 980 of a right to jury trial for the actual commitment proceeding.
Let me, if I may, just... So, the question whether or not, in order to initiate a 51 proceeding, you need any kind of recency for a 980, your answer is?
My answer is that I believe the definition of sexually violent person in Chapter 980 does not, in that would be 980.01 sub 7, does not explicitly require a finding of recent
and
activity
so,
or danger.
Normally for 51, and to employ Chapter 51, that's recency is one of the elements you need. You can't go under 51 unless you need recency. But for 980, you're saying that doesn't apply. Other things in 51 apply, but not the recency.
I think it's, let me answer your question this way. I think it's important to keep in mind the distinction between the commitment standards under Chapter 51 as compared to the commitment standards under Chapter 980, as compared to the standards for involuntary administration of medication under 5161. And I say that for this reason. Constitutionally, a commitment, a civil commitment, is in fact not required prior to entering an order for involuntary medication.
What do you do with the Roberta S. case that suggests at least there's a due process problem under Chapter 55 and 80 if you try to administer forcibly medications without initiating a separate Chapter 51 proceeding? That had constitutional dimensions, as I recall reading.
The problem in Roberta S., or the sort of basis for the Court of Appeals rationale in Roberta S., was that Roberta S. had been protectively placed under Chapter 55, and she had a guardian appointed under Chapter 880. You're absolutely right, Justice Bradley. Individuals receiving services or placement under Chapter 55 also qualify as patients under 5161. Certainly, then, an argument could have been made that the 5161 procedures for involuntary medication applied to Roberta S. The Court of Appeals does not expressly address that issue in its decision. I don't know if it's because the parties didn't present it. I didn't obtain the briefs to determine that. But it is clear that the Court of Appeals never asks and answers the question, could we follow 5161 and get to the order that way?
What do you understand the holding of that case to be?
I understand the holding of that case to be when dealing with an individual who is protectively placed under Chapter 55 and receiving services under, with a guardian under Chapter 880, that the protective purposes of the guardianship scheme at issue don't appear to give authorization for the entry of an order for involuntary administration of medication. Another very important point is that Chapter 880 at the time, in 880.33 sub 4M, authorized the appointment of a guardian for the purposes of consenting to or refusing the administration of psychotropic medication. The statute at that time said nothing about the guardian's authority to participate in any effort to involuntarily medicate the ward if the ward refused to take the medication. And so the Court of Appeals, reading that statutory scheme, I think rightly took the legislature at its word and said, this is as far as the legislature intended courts to go when dealing with an individual who had a guardian appointed under Chapter 880. Subsequent to the Roberta S. decision, the legislature amended Chapter 880 and created a procedure for involuntary administration of medication.
Well, how do you go about involuntary medication under 51.611G? In other words, are there any differences that you would do to a Chapter 51 person?
As opposed to an individual committed under Chapter 980?
Yes. I want to know whether you can just follow it right down the line in one of the lines, or is there a difference? Or do we have to make a modification in effect? Because your brief had said, well, if we don't do 51.611G, that we should set up our own scheme.
Well, I don't recall saying that, but perhaps I did. I'll take your word for it.
Into your brief.
I'll take your word for it. Certainly it would be true that if the court chooses not to follow the procedures laid out in 5161, there are constitutional requirements that have to be met, and it would be our position that the circuit courts could follow those constitutional requirements and get to the same place. But back to your question of what has to be done under 5161, the procedure that Judge Dugan followed in this case is found in 5161.1G3, and that is a procedure for the entry of an order for involuntary administration of medication following a final commitment order. And in a nutshell,
and the commitment order here would be under 980.
Correct. Right? The commitment order had been entered under Chapter 980. So the procedure in a nutshell is that a motion or petition for an order for involuntary medication has to be filed. A report from a doctor may be attached to that motion, but it's not required under 5161.1G3. The court is then required to make a determination following a hearing that the individual is not competent to refuse medication under the standards set forth in 1G4. Or that a situation exists in which the medication or treatment is necessary to prevent serious physical harm to the individual or to others. The section goes on to note that the hearing under this subdivision must meet the requirements of 5120 sub 5, and those are fairly explicit due process requirements, including the right to counsel, the right to present and cross-examine witnesses, and the like. One of the important differences to note about the procedures that were set up in Chapter 971 and 975, also discussed earlier, is that under 971 and 975, a report from a doctor must be filed with the request for involuntary medication. It's not optional, it's required. And secondarily, under both 971 and 975, if the district attorney, the subject individual, and their counsel all waive collectively their right to an evidentiary hearing on the motion, the court may proceed to decide the involuntary medication question on the strength of the report alone. So it's a fairly significant difference, actually, in the procedures between 5161 and 971 and 975. That waiver option is not available under 5161. A hearing has to be held.
Counsel, one of my questions, and you may have answered it just by that, but one of my questions is, look, why does the legislature need to enact 971 and 975 if it's mentioned, those are mentioned, 971 and 975 are under the definition of patient of 51.61. My question is, isn't that just superfluous? I mean, if you already have a 5161 procedures for a forcible administration of medication, if you already have that, then they could have spent their time better doing something else. It's just superfluous. Is your response the procedures are a little different? Is that so? It isn't superfluous. Is that what you?
That would be one of my responses. Yes, that the procedures are actually slightly different, and there may have been reasons in the legislature's mind to create that waiver provision in 971 and 975, and not to provide it in 5161. One of the reasons, if I may speculate, one of the reasons may have been that the 971 and 975 proceedings are essentially an alternative resolution to the criminal trial, and so there's sort of a feeling that one would move right into this involuntary administration of medication issue from the actual substantive trial, and those issues may have been in fact discussed already in the previous proceedings. 5161.1G3 allows for an order for medication some months, perhaps even years, after a commitment has already been entered, so the issues are not going to be fresh in anyone's mind necessarily. Another response, I guess, to that question is that a sort of theme running through Anthony's argument in this case is that there ought to be one way for the legislature to establish substantive rights and establish the procedures that go with them, and we ought to essentially require the legislature to put it all in the same chapter. I certainly would agree that all of our jobs would be easier if the legislature would do it that way. But the fact of the matter is that if you look simply at the various commitment schemes we've been discussing today, they cross-reference one another in a wide variety of places. Sometimes the legislature cross-references a standard in another chapter. Sometimes it adopts it wholesale. There's no one way that the legislature is required to express its intent about what direction and what steps it wants circuit courts to follow.
Counsel, I understood, and maybe I misunderstood, I understood the argument primarily not to be, hey, let's have it neat and clean and all in 51, but rather the legislature didn't do it here. Am I missing? That was, I understood, the primary argument of your opposing counsel, that the legislature did it in 975, the legislature did it in 971 patients. The Roberta case talks about 55 and 880 cases. So if the legislature wants to do it, it certainly can do it. Maybe it should do it. But there's nothing in 980 that has done it. That's what I understand the major focus. Do you disagree with that, my understanding?
I don't agree with that assessment of Anthony's major focus.
That?
I don't agree with the assessment that that's the major focus.
Okay, good. Tell me then.
No, that's
what
absolutely
what
right. That's certainly right. The state's position would be that by defining individuals committed under Chapter 980 as patients in 5161, the legislature did what it needed to do to extend those rights in 5161 to individuals committed under Chapter 980.
It doesn't extend to all of them, right?
It doesn't extend them to the extent that there is specific that there are specific provisions in Chapter 980 that would conflict. In that case, I agree that the Chapter 980 provisions would control. And to the extent that this court develops other exceptions along the way, certainly that could happen as well.
But in the Court of Appeals, we had a concurring opinion that seemed to be the lead opinion until I read it.
I had the same problem.
Which opinion do you think is stronger, or are there faults with both?
Well, the majority opinion of the court, the secondary opinion signed by Judges Fine and Curley, I believe adopts the approach that the state would have had the Court of Appeals and would have this court take, which is that circuit courts have authority under Chapter 980 by virtue of that chapter's direction to courts to commit for control, care, and treatment to enter orders for involuntary medication, and the legislature provided the procedures to accompany that power in 5161. The problem with Judge Schutzen's opinion, in the state's view, is that Judge Schutzen did feel constrained by Roberta S. and did feel an obligation to go back and reevaluate not just the involuntary medication procedures, but also the entire commitment scheme under Chapter 51 as compared to Chapter 980. That was never an issue in the Court of Appeals, and it really is a superfluous part of the opinion.
Let me not feel constrained by Roberta S.
Well, yeah, what would you like us to say about Roberta S.?
It seems to me that Roberta S. is limited to the circumstance where you have a statutory scheme like Chapter 55 and Chapter 880, where there is explicit direction for providing care and protection for wards. The court went to some trouble to talk about the fact that the legislature had established a guardianship scheme for the purposes of consenting to or refusing medication and had not gone the step further to say that the guardian could also participate in involuntary administration of medication. The legislature has now gone that further step, and so the continuing vitality of Roberta S., I think, is in some doubt as to that point.
Ms. Timberlake, there is a footnote on the majority opinion that talks about Roberta S., and let me ask you what you think this means, because I had some trouble following, basically referring and citing Roberta. The court says Roberta was not a case whereas here, the legislature specifically applied provisions of Chapter 51 stats to persons committed under a different statute. Roberta S. has absolutely nothing to do with the issue here. Were they getting at what you were just telling Justice Prosser and Justice Bablich, or do you think they had something further they were getting at with that?
I'll do my best. I had some trouble with the footnote as well. I think that there are two possible ways to read that footnote. One would be to perhaps assume that the court overlooked the fact that Chapter 55 is cross-referenced in 5161.1 and just didn't notice it. That's one possibility. The second possibility is that the cases are not uniform in their description of a 55 placement as a commitment. Sometimes the cases talk about 55 orders as commitments, sometimes they don't. And so it's possible that these two judges also felt that a 55 proceeding is really not a commitment of the same type that we have under 51-971.
Well, but 5161 makes that clear. It says patient means an individual who's receiving services, etc., under 48 or 55, and then it says, or who is detained, committed, or placed under this chapter, 48, 55. So the drafters seem to take that into account and have two references to 55.
Right, covered both for both.
Whereas that really then means they didn't read subsection 1.
That's how it would appear to me as well.
Counsel, I touched on the argument of things being superfluous with your interpretation, and you responded accordingly. Let me try another superfluous. As I understand it, 980 was amended to allow for the administration of drugs. Is that right?
Not exactly. 980 was amended to discuss a particular subclass of individuals who may be treated with drugs, and that would be serious child sex offenders who may be treated with anti-androgen drugs.
And the amendment allowed for the administration then for a certain kind of 980 for anti-androgen drugs. Is that right?
I don't read the amendment to actually necessarily allow for the administration of those anti-androgens, and by that I mean I don't read the legislature to be saying now these drugs may be administered and previously they couldn't be. What I understand the effect of that amendment to be is the legislature is simply directing the courts, first of all, in choosing between institutionalization and supervised release, the legislature is directing the courts to give some thought to whether an individual may be amenable to treatment with anti-androgen drugs by virtue of being a serious child sex offender. And then secondly, in Chapter 980, the legislature also gives direction to the department to whom the individual is committed to give some thought to those same issues when developing the treatment plan at issue.
So you don't see the amendment authorizing the administration of anti-androgen drugs?
Not expressly. I certainly don't see it as prohibiting that either, but I don't think that was the legislature's intent.
Because the argument on being superfluous is, why would you need that?
It also amended a variety of other chapters having to do with the same issues, having to do with serious child sex offenders and anti-androgen drugs. And so it was a sort of overall scheme that the legislature was putting into place.
What would be the matter with getting a commitment under 51? And so he's committed under 980, he's committed under 51, the state has full control. Would that be very harmful?
There are two problems with, perhaps more than two, there are several problems with requiring that in this case. The first and foremost being that it would fail to give effect to the legislature's intent in creating Chapter 980 as a commitment scheme and a control scheme and a treatment scheme for the appropriate individuals. Aside from that, though, there are, in fact, some fairly significant differences between a Chapter 51 commitment and a Chapter 980 commitment, the principal one being that Chapter 51 commitments expire after a year. And after 1 year, it's not simply a paper review or a court review of the commitment. There has to be a whole
that
new
seems
trial.
That reasonable when you're going to give them these kind of drugs. I mean, if you want to give them the drugs, why shouldn't you give them all the benefits that the state has done to give them the drugs. I mean, it's not aspirin, right?
Absolutely not. That's right.
Got really, aspirin has its own dangers, right?
It
does. And these are very significant drugs. So does the state want to keep on giving them the drugs without a review?
Absolutely not. Absolutely
not. It's a paper review.
Well, not entirely. The review process, both in Chapter 51 and in Chapter 980, by that I mean the review of the individual's commitment status, placement, mental status, all of that, both of those reviews happen under 51 as well as under 980. They happen under 51 in 5120 sub 17, and they happen in 980 under 980, I believe it's 07. And in both cases, the review of the individual's status, are they ready to go to a less restrictive environment, that sort of thing, happens at the hands of staff at the institution. It's not a court that's in the first instance conducting that review. However, under both statutory schemes, the results of that examination and that assessment of the patient are then filed with the committing court. So, in fact, the subject individual gets the benefit both of the medical personnel who are working with him or her and know the issues, and it also gets the benefit of having that information. He also gets the benefit of having that information filed with the committing court, so that if there is a need for the court to modify its order, that can happen.
So under both situations, it's the exact same thing?
It's not exactly the same.
Okay, tell us what the differences are.
The one difference in those review procedures that I mentioned is that under 512017, that reassessment happens every 6 months, and under 980.07, it happens annually. So the state is certainly not taking the position that an individual may be involuntarily medicated and that's it. They're forever after at the mercy of their doctors with no further review. That's absolutely not the case.
How do you get a hearing? I mean, it's filed. Thousands of papers are filed every day in one of these large counties. How does a judge ever get to see them, right? And really think them through?
Sure. Under 980, there are two ways that could happen. First of all, under 980.07 sub 3, the court may actually order a reexamination of the person sooner than 1 year. And I assume if the court reaches out and does that, it would want some results and it would want to hear about it.
It would be highly unusual for a court to do that sua sponte.
Could be. However, also under 980.08 permits the subject individual to petition for supervised release essentially every 6 months. And that is a process where, so long as enough time has elapsed, a hearing is scheduled, and presumably issues about the orders that are in place as to that individual, as well as the question of that individual's institutionalization versus supervised release, could be raised. The other thing that I would add is that Judge Crabb, in her Ennis decision, which is cited by both sides in their briefs, holds that some review of the involuntary medication order is constitutionally required. She doesn't hold that it has to be judicial review. She simply holds that it has to be review. But to the extent that this court feels that review is constitutionally required and that the procedures in 980 are for any reason inadequate to provide that review, the court could read them in.
We could read them in. Well, what do you think should be required more than now in 980?
I think that the
involuntary medication.
It's the state's position that the intersection between 980 and 51 is adequate, both as to the hearing procedures provided under 5161 and as to the review that's available under 980. There really is no way to read 980 to find it deficient in terms of the
required
review.
Required court hearing in 980.08?
I believe so, but let me just check if I could. Yes, in 980.08 sub 4, the court without a jury shall hear the petition within 30 days after the report, et cetera, et cetera. The individual, the patient does have to wait at least 6 months since his last attempt at supervised release was denied. What we have in this case is the legislature having made a clear choice to extend patients' rights in 5161 to individuals committed under Chapter 980. This case presents the clear circumstance of an individual who is clearly in need of the medication. This case also presents a circumstance to demonstrate that the administration of medication serves both of Chapter 980's goals. It serves the goal of protecting the public, and it serves the goal of making it possible to treat Anthony. The testimony from Anthony's psychiatrist at Mendota, Dr. Martha Raleigh, was clear that when not medicated, Anthony has to be kept in almost total isolation. He is dangerous to himself, he is dangerous to others, and he certainly is not available to be treated when he's in that unmedicated state. This court should give effect to the legislature's choice in extending the patient's rights procedures in 5161 and should affirm the decisions below. Thank you.
I ask one other question. If you're looking solely at Chapter 980, is there one place that you would point to looking solely at Chapter 980 as authority for the court to issue such an order?
Yes, that would be 980.06 sub 1, which is the direction to courts to order individuals committed for control, care, and treatment. That authority includes the authority to enter the order that was entered here, provided the proper procedures are followed.
What check? Sexual predators are not high on anyone's list. You know, support group, there's no constituency.
No fan club, no.
So what check is there? Absent specific legislation in 980 on potential abuse for forced medication.
The check is in 5161 itself, and it's in really two places. First of all, the standard for finding incompetence to refuse medication, which has to be met before an order for involuntary medication can be entered, except for the limited dangerousness exception, provides that the court must find that the individual is incapable of expressing an understanding of advantages and disadvantages or cannot apply that understanding to him or herself because of mental illness, developmental disability, alcoholism, or drug dependence. Those are the criteria. They were met in this case. They probably wouldn't be able to be met in every Chapter 980 case. So it's clear that applying the 5161 procedures, those very stringent protections are available. Secondarily, another patient's right that it would be our view applies to 980s is in 5161.1H, which is a right to be free from unnecessary or excessive medication at any time. Of course, that exception goes on to note that when medication is ordered under sub G, the individual has to take it. But the H exception also notes that medication may not be used as punishment, may not be used for the convenience of staff, may not be used as a substitute for a treatment program, and may not be used in quantities that interfere with the patient's treatment program. So that in itself is a secondary protection and a secondary direction, if you will, to both courts and treatment programs not to use these sorts of drugs lightly. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Timberlake. Ms. Hennick?
There is a very real problem with using supervised release as a method for reviewing medication orders. First of all, as a practical matter, you could have someone who in no way can make allegations that would meet supervised release but might need changes in medication orders. The two things, if you look at the standards for supervised release, are clearly not the same thing. Number two, as a very practical matter, the way that this works is if a patient petitions on their own, pro se, for supervised release, appointment of counsel does not come until that petition is filed. Now, if you look at the testimony in this case, this is not a case in which medicating Anthony D.B. ends hallucinations. He still hallucinates on medication. There's no question about that. To ask him to be able to figure out, number one, that supervised release would get him a review of medication, when it's certainly not so crystal clear that we're saying that here, and number two, to actually get it together to file that petition, is asking an awful lot of just the kind of person who's not likely to be capable of doing it.
Well, so under your interpretation, then, there's no way, under current law, is your argument that under current law, the only way that he can be forced to take psychotropic medication is through initiating a Chapter 51 procedure?
Yes.
But Chapter 51 requires recent acts of dangerousness.
Yes. In this case, it can be met. I mean, that was conceded below. Whether that may be a problem in some other cases, I don't know. But the mere fact that he's been in an institution doesn't mean that... Because remember, you can also be dangerous to yourself. And there's testimony in the record that Anthony chews his own lip, fails to eat, and does some other things that would clearly present a danger to himself. So it's not clear that you would necessarily not be able to meet it in a 980 either, if your facts were correct. If you had the right set of facts.
But aren't you admitting that in many cases it would not be met?
I think in many cases it might not be met.
So if you couldn't get someone admitted under 51 and they can't be medicated under 980, they just don't get the medication and they get crazier and crazier, is that right?
Well, at a certain point, even within an institution, one can manifest dangerousness. The fact that one's in an institution does not mean that one can't lash out at guards or in some way try and harm oneself. I mean, the two things don't necessarily go together.
So if he is mentally incompetent but harmless, he shouldn't be involuntary medicated. Because he wouldn't fit Chapter 51. Mm-hmm.
And that's true as it stands,
true.
Yes.
So you're saying, okay, so what? In effect.
Well, I think what you would have to do is you would either have to spend some time convincing him, or you would have to wait to the point where it interferes with something seriously. And when you're talking about the kind of medication that you have here, that may be exactly the right balance. Because to medicate someone and take into account some of the neurological problems, some of the heart problems, I think you have to have a real good likelihood of some sort of outcome that's going to make a significant difference.
You're saying you can't medicate if they're exceedingly disturbed but harmless under 980, and you can't medicate them forcibly if they're exceedingly disturbed but harmless under 51 either. I mean, you need
right.
heart, you need dangerousness as a condition.
But to some extent, we've accepted that all along. I mean, if you really wanted to say, hey, we've committed them for treatment and for the protection of the public, we've committed them for treatment, you have to say, well, if that's enough, then we ought to be able to force any treatment we want. What's the limitation on that? I mean, logically, if it's enough to say, well, this would help his treatment, then we can order anything that will help his treatment to any one of the sexual predators. I don't see that there's any real dividing line.
Which has nothing to do with the reason that the person is there.
Right. I don't see that there's any real dividing line there. Can you take somebody, for example, who would not, by any of the standards, meet Chapter 51, but has some of the mental disorders that we've accepted under 90. Let's say somebody is somewhat obsessive compulsive. Can we take one of the medications for that and just say, well, you know, it would be real easy, much easier to handle him in group if he just stopped perseverating? I mean, is that how far we're willing to go? And I think that that's part of the question. Thank you.
Suppose we view that the legislature could not have had in mind that you're going to just let somebody be in an institution, be mentally ill, and just languish, and that the state views it as cruel and inhuman treatment to do that when there are drugs available, in the state's opinion. I can then see that you would say, and maybe Judge Crabb would say, that the provisions under 980 on review, as you have said in your argument, are just not good enough. That a six-month review for release is not six-month review for medication. And that for due process grounds, to give these kinds of drugs involuntarily, you've got to have periodic review. Otherwise, he is institutionalized and has no possibility of stopping this. So suppose we made repairs to fit the constitutional arguments as I see them or have expressed them, and we say you get an automatic six-month review on drugs. And every 6 months, doctor has to file a report, and judge has to review it, and you didn't even require a hearing.
I think that fixes the constitutional problems. Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. And I think you have to require it, or you have a constitutional problem. That's not to say, however, that that's the same thing as saying the legislature intended for this to happen.
I know. I prefaced it with finding that kind of intent from the tenor and context of all of these statutes, including a 980 treatment, and I would read it broader than just treating him here for his sexual problem. So you'd have to find that as a base, but do you think you'd have to add to this to make it constitutional?
Yes, and I think that that's where I started.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Hannick. Before I conclude, I just want to make, again, my thanks to Kenosha County and